Accession number 18730, Reel 4.
Jim Cox, Reel 4.
Well, somehow I knew that along this track there was a water point with something, I believe about 8 pipes came up out the ground. They'd found some water there somehow, and all the water bowsers went and filled up there. So although the section behind me were grumbling at the pace I was going, I'd got my eyes on this water and I knew it was just over the brow of a hill. And as we got over it, I saw, when out at the water point, I gave them a shout, and they must have met up with a similar instance, because immediately one chap went, grabbed a huge jerry can full of water, and he stood at the roadside as we went by with mugs ready, and he sloshed a mug full of water. And so the section was then quite happy that I hadn't been leading them too fast. We were out of sight of anyone else and got a drink. But anyway, we eventually found our way back to camp, and we met by the Sergeant Major. Wanted to know what we were doing there, and I pointed out that we were the first section to lead the exercise back, and he immediately dismissed us, get the kit off and get the tiffin. Okay. Well, then soon after that we were to embark from Tripoli. We were transported down to Tripoli and boarded the LCIs for destination unknown to us. But just before I go on that voyage, I'd just like to drop back for an interesting point or two that occurred at Chequers when I was serving in there. As I believe I explained, there was always a good lunch party. The table was always full, and again at dinner at night, Mr. Chetts led all the VIPs concerning the war. Some stayed for one meal, some for two, some overnight, and so on. But one night, just got dusk, a car rolled up in the courtyard at the back of the house. I thought, hello, what's this? So I wandered over, and out of the car climbed Mr. Anthony Eden. Where do I want to be? Asked Mr. Eden. I said, well, you don't want to be here, sir. I said, your driver has missed the front door, and I started to direct the chauffeur back to the front door. Oh, that doesn't matter, Mr. Eden said. I'll walk. The walk will probably do me good. So I directed him round the outer perimeter wall to the grounds, and off he went. But I hadn't thought about the flying sentries, and the next thing, Mr. Eden was met by a flying sentry who challenged him, and in answer to his challenge, Mr. Eden says, I'm Anthony Eden. But the disbelieving sentry says, like bloody hell you are, and whipped him into the guard room quick. And the PM's bodyguard, Inspector Special Branch, had to go and bail him out, sort of thing. And this Inspector Special Branch, he was also a very officious man, and such like people, they soon get be known by everyone around them, and particularly the sentries. They didn't give him any rope, but it just shows that, you know, however well trained you are, you can still slip up. And this inspector had, finding himself short of cigarettes, thought he would wander down to the camp one evening for a supply, leaving his sergeant in charge of the But he didn't ascertain the password, current password. When he wanted to return to the house, he too was stopped by the sentries, and they locked him up, much to his annoyance. But they'd done the right thing, and the butler had to go down and bail him out. But of course he was a laughing stock to the house staff, sentries and everybody for several days. I've often been asked what Mr. Churchill was like, but of course I couldn't really answer that question. I didn't come in contact with him enough, although I bumped into him on occasions. But one little instance might bear a little bit in that line. As we know, the upstairs, downstairs in such households, where upstairs are practically not allowed downstairs, but of course they never venture. But not Winston. He was a man that rules and fetters didn't stop him. If he wanted to do a thing, he did it. One evening at dinner, something that had been served didn't please him. So he got up from the table, left his guests, and wandered down to the kitchen to have a word with the cook. Of course, she explained it away. She said, well, the rationing even reaches my kitchen. Mr. Churchill, satisfied with that answer, departed. Whereupon the cook let everyone within hearing know, Mr. Churchill invading my kitchen. Now, that's not on. He had no business to come down here. She then, the penny dropped, and she did a jig around the Aga cooker, chanting, I've spoken to the Prime Minister, I've spoken to the Prime Minister. Well, that suited us all. Now, Winston decided at that time, while I was there, that he would do a tour of the East Coast defences. Of course, the fear of invasion was still around, and a special train was ordered, and his escort, two bodyguards and everything connected with him boarded this train. Various defences. Now, in the station goods yard at Stallingborough, not a 100 yards or approximately from where my parents dwelt, they were mounted on railway wagons, two 12-inch howitzers, and anchored to the ground. These were for the defences, apparently, of the Humber estuary, if needed. And Winston must come to see these. Well, they left the train at Grimsby and boarded cars and with various army personnel, VIPs of the army, with them, plus bodyguards. My dear old grandmother stood outside her cottage, quite near, as in a terrace road, the same as my parents lived, one morning, taking the air, saw this cavalcade pass by, and she thought she recognised her Prime Minister. She watched his car turn into the goods yard. So off she went, curiosity getting the better of her. She wandered down there, saw this group of people inspecting and discussing the guns, howitzers, and wandered right in amongst them. No one checked her. No one said, what are you doing? She got within yards of the Prime Minister, said to him, you're Mr. Churchill, aren't you? Mr. Churchill turned and said, I am that, Granny. Well, of course, Grandmother was absolutely dumbstruck and backed out, but not a word had been said to her from any of the bodyguards, army personnel, and it appears that any old woman could wander up to the Prime Minister, and that's security in this country.
Which year would that have been?
1940-41. I can't remember to the month in question. No, 41, I would say. Yeah. Anyway, we're now back to the landing craft. Oh, no. Previous to this, while the Desert War was still on, we were out the line for 2 days, but the 201st Guards Brigade, to which I belong, was a mechanised brigade, so every section had a vehicle of its own, sort of thing. And when we were out and parked, you would park, I forget what it was, 100 to 200 yards apart, in case of any aircraft coming and blowing up two or three at once. Well, these were very handy because you sat in the shade of them and smoked and talked and brewed up. Now, the Padre, a jovial little fella, always a smile on his face, would wander around from truck to truck, but he always came in on the blind side of you. But he would leave, ask how we were, and leave. At this particular time, a drumhead service was ordered, so all had to attend that could. And the Padre started his service with him and a prayer. He then mounted his pulpit to an upturned ammunition box, and he started by saying, "I have only one word for my text this morning, just one word. Fuck." Well, we were used to the use and the sound of that word, but the desert was very still. I think you could have heard the desert rat squeaking. But it did go on for a time. I don't remember the last of that service. I know it hit me somewhere deep. But went on to explain. He said, "I am sick and tired of hearing that one word," he said. "Everything you utter, it's F the desert, F the rations, F the Germans, F the war." He said, "If only you would use some other obscenity, I wouldn't care so much, but that one word," he said, "is sickening me."
Was he the Padre of the Third Coldstreams?
That would be, yes, we'd battalion Padre, didn't we? Yes, yeah. I can't remember his name. He's a jovial little fella and always smiling. That's all I can remember about him. I believe he was later killed in Italy. He didn't last long when we eventually invaded Italy. Anyway, we eventually got down to these LCIs again and crammed in there among your kit. It was absolutely impossible to sleep. You may have nodded, but you slept. And we set off, not knowing where we were going at the time. I believe, if I remember right, it was somewhere around 10 o'clock at night. No, it would be earlier than that, because when we all got going across the Mediterranean, there were LCIs to the front of you, LCIs behind you, LCIs to the side. In fact, the whole Mediterranean was dotted with LCIs. But that night, there was a storm blew up. And I was really, I felt worse than I did on the Queen Mary when we first left England on it. But in the morning, daylight came, and one of our officers emerged on deck, looked around, said, "I do think it's too bad. The others might have kept together." I thought, well, it might be us that's damn well lost, which of course it was. And we were leaguered up again then on the, be about the east coast of Sicily. And we gathered together, but of course this had given the German spotter planes chance to see us. Instead of sailing direct to wherever we were going, we had by then been told that we'd be landing halfway up Italy at some place called Salerno. We set off again the next night and landed somewhere about 6 o'clock in the morning, the next morning. The third Coldstream were in reserve, which is all very nice at first, but you have to stop and think that you'll be needed where the trouble is. Someone up front meets up with some heavy resistance, that's where you'll be sent. But we were then back as infantry, of course, and attached to the Black Cat Division, which in itself was attached to the 5th American Army under General Clark. And a lot of our exploits from then on, and have been written in history, I note, are put down as the Americans, but the Americans, yes, but it was us, part of their army that was doing it. Nevertheless, we landed at 6 o'clock, as I said, and we hung about until middle of the afternoon, or late afternoon, when we were told, right, we are wanted at Batapaglia, which I believe was somewhere about 5 miles south of Salerno Beach, and we set off down a dusty old track, kept seeing up one of our lads down, and then you saw a guardsman, Scotch guardsman, I remember, and you began to think, yes, they shoot guardsmen as well. But we were going to relieve the Fusiliers, we were told, who were in trouble at Batapaglia. We got there in the dark, and a whisper came back, an order I never wished to hear. All us dreaded the day that order came. Fix bayonets, but quietly. Thankfully, they weren't needed. The Germans' tactics, hit and withdraw, once again, they'd withdrawn out of Batapaglia. What puzzled me was that we couldn't find or never saw any sign of these Fusiliers. And I puzzled for years about that. There weren't no dead bodies, there wasn't any kit laid about as if people had been taken prisoner and discarded the kit. There was just nothing but us. One company of Coldstream and one company of Grenadiers the other side of the road. And we dug in that night, digging all night. The next day, of course, the Germans came back, and we had a anti-tank gun. Was it a 2-pounder belonging to the battalion behind us? And there was a tank came down a lane, and I remember when the gunner officer of the anti-tank gun wanted to take aim and fire, there was only one spot where he could have done, and that was a big gap in the edge. There was a big edge there, and a sunken road this tank had come down. And just in front of his gun was a section that dug in. And he shouted to the sergeant in charge, "Get your section out, Sam." Well, there was quite a bit of noise from small arms fire. The Germans were firing, throwing a few hand grenades, etc. And we had, of course, been reinforced before this invasion started, and we had a lot of green troops with us. And when they looked up to see what was happening, they saw this section getting up and moving, and panic struck the whole company, and out they went. Apart, I might say, from one Bren gunner who sat there with his gun in action, my platoon officer and myself. Now, the men had left the kit with the Bren gun magazines in the kit still, and my platoon officer and myself were running about among all this small arms fire, and hand grenades were bursting all among us, collecting Bren gun magazines and running back to this Bren gunner, whose gun was literally, well, he had several burns on his arm, I noticed, from the barrel alone by the time we'd finished. But the Germans once again withdrew.
Which company and platoon were you in?
Which platoon? I can't remember because they used a number I cannot remember. But it was... I can't even remember the number of the platoon. It was number 4 platoon, but it was... the officer in charge was a Mr. Lumley. Anyway, we sat there and eventually the rest of the company came back. The company commander, he'd gone with them and he came back. And he came up to Mr. Lumley and he said, "Richard, you had better deploy the company. You know more of what's happening than what I do now." And Mr. Lumley turned and looked at me and he said, "You had better go to that forward slit trench," he said, "because you're the only man in the company I can trust." Well, enough said. Later in the day, there appeared two target outs, came down the main street. One turned his attention on the grenadiers on the other side, and one on us. And he was firing his heavy gun straight into our slit trenches. And his machine guns on either wing were splaying the ground above. Well, this was absolute suicide to stay in, almost, and we were ordered out that time because no one could stand there for long. And out they went. But I'd been sent to this forward slit trench and I cast one eye up, thought we'll have the whole width of that fire to go through. I haven't a cat in hell's chance of getting through there in one piece. I'll stay where I am, which I did, until the firing had stopped. The company had gone, the firing had stopped, the tank withdrew again. I then crept out of my slit, picked up my rifle and a bit of gear, looked up for a quick exit. And there was a lad, he was not 20, 25 yards away from me, but he was wandering in the wrong direction. He was wandering towards the Germans. I thought, well, he's wounded. He doesn't know where he is. And I called to him, and I said, "Come with me, lad," I said. You're going in the wrong way. I said, "Come with me." And he turned round, and his stomach had been ripped open from side to side. His innards, his entrails, he was actually walking about in his entrails in an absolute impossible mess. How he still stood there, I don't know. As he turned, he spread his hands towards me, and those were the last words I suppose he ever spoke. He said, "Well, fucking look at me." Well, I was at a deep loss then. I thought, well, there's nothing, whatever, any medics could do for that lad. I'm here on my own, literally. What am I to do? I thought, put him out of his misery. And I raised a rifle. I had a rifle then. Took aim between the eyes. And I never did get that trigger pulled. Looking down, back down the rifle, into my eyes were this lad's. He knew perfectly well what I was about to do. If he'd only turned his head the other way, I'd have put him out of his misery. But I was lost, absolutely. I turned and looked around me for a way of escape from this dilemma. And there was a chap staggering about, bent, almost double, but still staggering on his feet. I thought, well, there, I think, is a possibly a life I can save. I can't do nothing for that other lad. So I went to this chap staggering about. As he was bent nearly double, I was able to bend down under him. When I stood up, he laid across my chest. And I set off out with him at a jog, as quick as I could. But he was a tall fella and probably weighed about 12 stone. I remember his arm had been shot through, all but a little bit of skin on either side. And as I jogged along, his cold clammy hand kept swiping me across the face, so I did have to stop and tuck that in between us. And then on again. Eventually, I probably carried him somewhere between a quarter and half a mile before I came to a first aid post. And he lived and served in the training battalion, I believe, sometime after that. I then went on and found the rest of the company, what was left of it. We'd had a lot of casualties in there. They were skulking under the bushes, and the sergeant major somewhere had found a tin of pears, these sliced pears, and a spoon, and he was going from man to man, spooning half a pear into the mouths. And I just thought, it's like feeding a child in an armchair. Those 6 foot guards would have been reduced to the high chair. We hadn't been there long. Of course, I'd been actively employed. Running away with the enemy behind you isn't a very pleasant thing, apparently, but I'd been actively employed. I'd had some nasty things, but I was getting over it, and I was getting my breath back. And as I walked into the company, I remember very cheekily saying, I'm getting bloody fed up of being in there. I'll be old. I've come out. We filled our pockets then with ammunition and back we went, but it was decided that it was too hot a place, and we moved back a little bit further and spent another night digging in. The next day, the shells just kept dropping over. Not a barrage, but just the odd shell to stop you doing anything you needed to do. You had to keep your head down and you slip.